Well, good afternoon, and welcome to our annual event here in Arcadia, something we've enjoyed for many years in a row now, and the opportunity to bring Bakersfield and Los Angeles together in an activity, as well as have visitors from other areas. We have some from Arizona and a visitor from Chile. I hope you're able to meet her after services. But an opportunity to spend that day together, it's always enjoyable and something that we look forward to and appreciate, as well as the activity this evening, which raises funds for our activity fund, and I hope you'll stay around and enjoy some of that as well. I have chosen an appropriate topic for today, since we have an Italian theme potluck. I'm going to speak in the book of Romans, and it's not "When in Rome, do as the Romans," but it is a chapter in Romans that focuses on Christian living. We see a full chapter that discusses the life of a Christian and what is expected of a Christian or of an individual that should be living that way of life and as a part of the body for which they were called. First, we need to know, and we do know, that behavior is a vital part of a Christian life. Behavior. Years ago, there were individuals who claimed, well, behavior is not a doctrinal issue. And of course, several of them had a problem with that because, of course, we do understand and we know behavior is a doctrinal issue. Mr. Coker brought out the fact that rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. If that rebellion is a behavior, it's a choice, but it is as the sin of witchcraft. And, of course, we know that's a very important understanding or doctrinal teaching. The word doctrine means teaching. And behavior is something that is taught, and if we don't think that behavior is doctrinal, then we have some major issues. So we understand that behavior is a doctrinal issue. And the book of Romans goes through in this particular chapter and talks about that behavior. First, let's turn to Timothy to lay out an important foundation or base for this. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 14. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 14. He says, "These things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I'm delayed, I write so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of truth." I love this passage because it has several different statements and several different things that can be focused upon. But he says, so that you may know how you ought to conduct yourself. He said, you should know that there is a behavior that is expected. And he said, I'm writing to you and I hope to be there. But if not, I want you to know what behavior is expected. And he says, in the house of God, which is the church of the living God. So the church is the house of the living God. And hopefully we respect it as such. We're not called to be an island or called to be individuals who don't have a need to be a part of the church or part of the body. God has called us out. He's called us to be a part of something, and we're not alone. Now, we're called individually, and of course, our relationship and our repentance and our development as we go through the conversion process is something on an individual basis, but he's called us to something greater, and he's called us to be a part of something. So we're called to participate as members of a new family. We come from our various families. We come from various backgrounds. But he says, I've called you to be a part of something new and part of a new family. The church, the ecclesia, or called out ones, are part of the house of God. We now belong to that house. And as such, there's a behavior that's expected and is very much so doctrinal. It's a conduct, and the conduct of one who follows Jesus Christ, which is technically the description of a Christian. A Christian is one who follows the standards of Jesus Christ. And of course, we know that is one in which the Spirit of God is actively working. He states that in this house, it is the church, and the church is the pillar and ground of truth. And of course, we know that, or we wouldn't be here, or that should be the case. That we understand that this is where truth is. And it's established, and we are established in the truth, and we search for that as a part of being a part of the church. But we have to be there to be a part of it. If the church or those who are called out is the pillar and ground of truth, we have to be there and continue to develop in that. So let's turn to the book of Romans. We're going to look at Romans chapter 12. And Romans 12 is considered by some and by many the Christian living chapter. And I want to go through and look at some of these lessons and some of the behavior that God does expect of us when we are called to be a part of that body. Paul writes, he says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." So first off, we see that he's speaking to the members, he's speaking to the brethren. And he says, we have to present our bodies as a living sacrifice. Something we learn to do, especially as we go through the conversion process, we understand that it is something that is quite painful. But he states, it is our reasonable service. Translation from the Greek, according to Strong's Concordance, means your logical worship or your rational service. He said, this is what is expected of you, that you present yourselves a living sacrifice. That is an ongoing process. It is something that we do at baptism when we put the old man to death, but being a living sacrifice means now that we're living and continuing to walk in a new life as a part of a new family, that there is a behavior and a changing process, and it is a sacrifice because we give up our own desires, our own wants, our own needs, in some cases, to do what is right and to follow the examples that are being set for us. But it's a behavior that is expected within the body. It's our actions. So how do we become living sacrifices? Mr. Pennelly has covered this in a couple of topics recently and has gone through and explained that. Let's keep our place here in Romans. We're going to go back and forth to a few other scriptures besides Romans, but you can keep your place. Let's go to Galatians chapter 2. And Galatians chapter 2 explains, in part, what it is to be a living sacrifice. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. He says, I have been crucified with Christ. That's a sacrifice. We're sacrificing the old man, the old way of life. We give up rights to ourselves. We put the old man under, and so we are sacrificing that. And he said, I have been crucified with Christ. Understanding what Christ went through, but also now that we as individuals going through that same thing of putting to death ourselves. And he said, it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And again, that is an important thing to understand, that Jesus Christ lives in us. It's not just a matter of we have the Holy Spirit and we live like him, but he lives his life in us and through us. And it said, the life which I now live, I live in the flesh, and I live by the faith of the Son of Man, and this is a point that was being brought out in previous messages, who loved me and gave himself for me. It is the faith of Jesus Christ that is in us. And of course, we began to develop that, and it becomes our faith because that is the faith that is required. It's a living faith that's given to us, but it's also Jesus Christ living his life through us. All right, let's go back to Romans chapter 12. So he tells us we are to be living sacrifices. And in verse 2 he says, be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. That's a lesson for us and something that we can all work on individually. Proving what is good and acceptable and proving what is God's will. Now you can say, well, how do we know what God's will is? Because he tells us. And we can study God's word and we can be confident in so many things because God says, this is what I desire. This is my will. Or this is what I want you to do. And if God commands us to do it, that is his will. So there are ways of understanding, and it says here, proving what is good and acceptable, but also proving what God's will is. How do we not be conformed, or how does one conform to the world? It says, be not conformed to the world. The word actually means to pattern yourself after or to act in a certain fashion. So he said, don't pattern yourself after the world. He said, don't try to match what the world is doing and say, I'm going to become like that, or I want to be like that, or having worldly figures that we say, That's the person I want to grow up to be like, or that's the person I want to imitate. He said, don't pattern yourself after or fashion yourself after the world, or don't act like the world. That is a behavior. In other words, he's listing two different behaviors or forms of behavior that are being discussed. He said, don't conform, but be transformed. Conforming can be seen in various behaviors. Keeping up with the Joneses. No offense to the Joneses. Many of us would like to keep up with the Joneses as active as they are in what they do. But keeping up with the Joneses in a term of trying to be like everyone else or trying to be like our neighbors. Trying to have all the latest gadgets and styles. Society is pumped full of all the newest things, and everybody has to have the newest phone. Your phone may cost $400 or $500, but in 1 year, oh, that's the old style. You got up to the new phone and pay several more $100 to get the newer one. Continuing trying to have the best. Now, there's nothing wrong with having quality, and there's nothing wrong with certain things. But if we're always trying to have the latest things and trying to be up with the world on what is in, trying to be accepted or fit in to a certain crowd, group of people, or trying to fit in at work and be like everyone else because we don't want to be recognized as, oh, he's a Christian, he's different. I grew up working in construction. If you've ever worked in construction, they say it's like sailors on a ship. And it is. The language is not preferable, and there's a lot of things you have to avoid. And being in the church and working in construction was quite different. And individuals would say, you don't cuss like we do. Or how come you don't cuss? Or how come you don't work on Saturdays when we have to come in and work on Saturdays? We don't want to try to be accepted and to fit into the crowd or not to be noticed. Trying to appear to be like everyone else in dress, in style. Trying to walk the line of Christianity and worldliness. And again, it's a matter of trying to fit in. He said, don't be conformed. Don't pattern yourself after or try to look like others in the world. He said, I want you to be something different. I want you to come out of the world, as we're told in Revelation, but he said, I want you to be different. I want you to have a different action and a different behavior in life. So we're called to be different. Let's keep our place here in Romans, and let's look at Ephesians chapter 2. Many of Paul's writings do work well with one another as he explains certain things. But Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 1, he said, and you he made alive who were dead in your trespasses and sins. He said, you've been given a new life. You were dead in your trespasses. You had sinned. You had made mistakes. And he said, it had brought on you the death penalty. And he said, you were dead in your trespasses, but now he's made you alive. And he said, in which you once walked according to the course of this world. He said, you patterned yourself and you walked just like everyone else. There wasn't a difference. And of course, looking at individuals, sometimes we have no idea. And we say, well, that looks like they're just like everyone else. But we're called to be different. He said, you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. He says, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves. He said, we also had a pattern of behavior that looked just like that. The word is also translated, that statement is translated, we had our conduct just like that, in the lust of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, just as others. He said, there was no difference between us and the world. But God says, I want you to be different, and you are called to be something different. We're not to be like the rest of mankind. He said there's a different behavior that is expected. So to be conforming is to have the mind and focus and conduct on things that are physical. Because without God, that's what most of the focus of mankind is on. It's on physical things. It's on money, power, greed, cars, houses, these physical things, and it's other things besides God. And he says, this is the physical mind. As he goes through and explains, the lust of the flesh and fulfilling the desires of the flesh, whatever it may be. But it's a focus on the here and now. And he says, you had this mind of focusing on the here and now, focusing on the physical just like everyone else, and it is inspired by Satan as the prince of the power of the air. Barnes notes, states, be not conformed. The word rendered conformed properly means to put on a form, a fashion or appearance of another. You're trying to be like another. Well, we're told, don't conform. Don't try to pattern yourself after another. I'm going to tell you how you need to live. It says it may refer to anything pertaining to the habit, manner, dress, and style of living of others, being like other individuals. Now, there are certain individuals, and especially, you know, we look at individuals who, examples of, as we looked at today, David. Now, he had problems in his life, but he was an example, and there were certain things that we could learn to live by, and he was a godly example, a man after God's own heart. But he does not want us to pattern ourselves after worldly figures. So he says, don't be like the world, we're called out of it. And he tells us that we need to be transformed. It's a whole different approach. It's a different effort. It is a harder effort because being transformed and going through a physical and metabolical change, it takes effort. And it's something that is something that we develop. It's not just a pattern of copying a behavior. And it is in a way because our children learn from us and they learn how to act. But then they're taught. And they learn that this is not just following what somebody else does. This is a pattern that is given to us by God. And it's something that when an individual begins to walk that way, it's not just that they're conforming to it or being like that. Is that they are changing. Transformation begins to cause a change in an individual that is different than just doing what other individuals do. Many of the over the years have conformed or had conformed to a pattern of behavior. They did what everyone else did. They fit in. They followed the examples of even those in the congregation. But when changes were made, they said, I'll follow whatever new change is given to me. I'll follow the new pattern. Transformation is being changed to where you realize there is not another pattern. God has laid out one pattern for us. And he says, well, you will come out of one. You come out of being conformed to like being like the world, and you are transformed. You begin to make a change, and that change is something that will affect an individual and will cause them to become something different. Barnes goes on, he says, be you transformed. The word from which the expression here is derived means form a habit. The word transformed is in the Greek morphe, to morph. We see movies where people morph from one thing into another. He says, you are to be transformed, you're to morph. The direction is to put on another form. To change the form of the world for that of Christianity. He said, you have a different thing that you're going to become like. You're not just going to pattern yourself like something. You're going to change and become something. Change into something. This word should properly be referred to the external appearance, but the expression which the apostle immediately uses, the renewing of the mind, shows that he did not intend to use it with that reference only, but the change of the whole man. Not just change in appearance that we look like a Christian, or that we look like and we pattern ourselves like a Christian, but that you have become a Christian. That you have become something different, and that change begins to go through an individual through the rest of their converted life. We go through a transformation process. But it's a change of a whole human being. And it starts with the implanting of God's Holy Spirit. When that Spirit is placed in us, we start a transformation process. The change doesn't happen completely later. We start that transformation now. God's Spirit begins to work with us, and we know the final step of that transformation is when we are changed to Spirit, something we all look forward to, and hopefully that time will come soon. But it begins with the renewing of the mind. And that word renewing, he said, I want you to be transformed by the renewing of your mind, means renovation. The renovation of the mind. He says, go through and clean out the old clean out the pattern of life that you had as following the world, renovate it all, and now I want you to create and build something new within the mind, so then that the individual is something new. It means a renovation. So we develop when we grow, when we mature, and eventually, as the word metamorph or metamorpho implies, we're changed into something that's entirely different. But the change begins at conversion. It begins when we leave one pattern of behavior behind and confirmation or conforming to the world, and now we begin a transformation, a change within the mind, a change within attitude, and eventually a change in physical to spiritual. We will be composed of spirit at some point, and as we get older, and I notice each year, as you get older, in your older years, each year you realize you're a lot older than just one year before. So you begin to figure out, I need a body that is spirit. You realize how physical you are and what changes you have to go through. But, so we have to go through that change, and we look forward to the final completion of that metamorphosis. But that does not happen if we are not transformed now. If that transformation process has not begun in the mind, and if we have not rejected patterning ourselves or conforming ourselves to the world. Now we get into some personal behaviors that are expected of any individual who is a member of the house of God. And again, these are behavioral. This is teaching. This is scriptural. What is expected of an individual who is a part of that house, which we are called and which we're part of today. Verse 3, Romans chapter 12 and verse 3. He says, "For I say, through the grace given to me, that everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." In our Christian behavior, as he goes through and he says, I don't want you to conform yourself to this. I want you to be transformed. I want you to be changed. And he starts off and he says, avoid pride. Avoid pride. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. It goes back to the sin that Satan had committed, Lucifer at the time, before he was changed. But he said, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but think soberly, think seriously, think on things that are important, and that as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. So in our Christian behavior, we are to avoid pride, and pride can come in many different ways. It has, and we've seen that over the years, even in the congregation, that pride can come in many different forms. There's vanity or pride of an individual of who they think they are, or being better than others. Meeting individuals and you find out who they are and you introduce themselves and you call them Mr. So-and-so and they say, I'm a doctor. You need to call me Dr. So-and-so. Oh, okay. Usually the conversation shorter after that. Individuals who, and there's nothing wrong because they have earned a degree, but there's a certain pride sometimes when individuals are focused on who they are, and the focus should be on proper respect towards them instead of meeting individuals and sharing a relation of all being called. There's pride over knowledge of what degree is held, or in some cases of knowledge of who an individual has known. You know, I know so-and-so, or I went back so far with these individuals, and so I know more than most people would realize, or I know more than other individuals. There's pride over looks, over clothing, over cars. There's pride over athletic ability, pride over musical ability, pride over intellect, what we call intellectual pride, where individuals pride themselves on knowing more or feeling they know more than other individuals. But he says, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. He said, learn to humble yourself and learn to bring yourself into a position of being teachable, but also in a position that you are able to work well within that body which you were called.
Matthew Henry's concise commentary says, "Pride is a sin in us by nature. We need to be cautioned and armed against it. All the saints make up one body in Christ, who is the head of the body and the common center of the unity. In the spiritual body, some are fitted for and called to one sort of work, and others to another sort of work. We are to do all the good we can, one to another, and for the common benefit." It's not that one studies more and becomes an intellect and, wow, that's, we need that part of the body more than we need any of the other parts of the body. Now he said, we're called for different purposes within that body. And he said, learn to fit in where you are called for the benefit and for the common benefit of others. And Paul brings that out in many places, not just here in Romans, but in other places where you are called to be a benefit to others in the congregation. I like this next statement from Matthew Henry's commentary. "If we duly thought about the powers we have and how far we fail to properly improve them, it would humble us." He said, if God has given us these special gifts and we fail to see them, we fail to recognize them, or fail to use them, he said it would humble us to see how far we fail in that. But as we must not be proud of our talents, we must take heed lest under pretense of humility and self-denial, we are slothful in laying ourselves out for the good of others. Even if you have talents and abilities that you're developing and you're using and you're working on, if you're not using it for the development and for the aid and for the helping of others, he said you're missing something in this point. Proverbs 3 verse 27 says, "Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, when it is in the power of your hand to do so." He said, if you have the opportunity to serve others and it's within your power to do that, don't withhold that. We don't want to withhold it because, well, I'm at a different class or level than other individuals in the congregation. No, he says, whatever you have, and if you have the ability to serve others, help others in whatever it may be, use that for the good of that body. We'll keep our place in Romans. Let's look at Philippians, because Philippians also has some behavior things that are part of a fellowship, a part of a congregation. We'll keep our place here and turn to Philippians chapter 2. And in verse 1, Philippians chapter 2 and verse 1. He said, "Therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, any comfort of love, any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy in being like-minded, having the same love and being of one accord and one mind." He said, yeah, you're called and you have a talents and abilities, but he said, I want you to understand these important things, that you are part of a body and you're called to be a part of that, not to set yourself above or set yourself as being over, but in the fellowship of the Spirit, having one mind, having the same love, being of one accord and of one mind, thinking in the same way. And in verse 3, he says, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit." So many times when God lays out a behavior that is expected, we're to avoid pride. He says, humble yourself, or avoid pride, or don't be prideful. But he says, don't let anything be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, he says, in humility. You need to be humble. Let each esteem others better than themselves. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interest of others. He said, don't just look out for your own interests. That's what the world does. It's all about me. It's about developing myself, and I'm not out for anybody else but myself. But he said, look out not only for your own interests, but the interest of others. Learn to be serving and learn to be outwardly focused and not just on the self. So the life of a true Christian is going to be one of humility and service, or humility and love. And that is what is brought out in the behaviors that are expected of us as we look at the behaviors that are given here in Romans chapter 12. Pride destroys, but edifying fulfills part of the purpose of our calling. Romans 14 and verse 18 says, "He who serves Christ in these things is acceptable to God and approved by men. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things which one may edify one another." He said, let's pursue the things that make for peace, but also the things which edify another person. Not just edifying ourselves, not just building up ourselves, but edifying or building up another. Ephesians 4 verse 15 says, "But speaking the truth in love, we need to grow up in all things into Him who is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body is joined and knitted together," just as Paul was explaining, we're all called to exhort one another, to build up one another. And he says, "by which every joint supplies," everybody doing their part, "according to the effectual working to which every part does its share, and it causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love," for the edifying of itself, of the body, and that's done in love. So vanity and pride are simply an exaltation of the edifying of the self, making the self, as pride does, puffed up. Behavior of a Christian is expected of us is for the edification of the entire body. That means we have to change and we have to develop that mentality and that attitude, not just because it's a pattern. Oh, I should serve because everybody else around me is serving. It's developing the mindset of I want to serve because I want to do my part within the body. So let's go back to Romans chapter 12. Romans 12 and verse 4. "For we have many members in one body, but all members do not have the same function." And we can read that. We understand that it's clear, but many over the years have said, well, I don't like the function I have, or I don't like where I'm at right now. I want a different responsibility or a different function. He said, "all the members do not have the same function. There is a purpose for which God places us in the body. He knows where we're best able to serve. And when we are given that Spirit of God, that is a gift, but we're also given gifts that we are to use. He knows what talents and gifts He's given us and what He expects us to do with those gifts. And so He said each one is given a purpose as a part of that body. Verse 5, "So we, being many, are one body in Christ and individually members one of another." He said, yeah, you're one body as a whole, but individually, you're also members one of another. How are we members one of another? I want to focus on this for a moment because I think many do not understand what Paul says when he says we're one body in Christ. Individually, we're members one of another. It almost sounds like a contradiction to what he's saying, but there is a specific meaning there. When we look at Barnes, Barnes Notes says, "we are one body, we're united together, constituting one society, one people, but we're mutually dependent and having the same great interest at heart." He said, "though to be promoted by us according to our special talents and opportunities." So we're mutually dependent on one another. Now we can come in and we can say, well, I don't need anybody, I don't need anyone or anything. And members have said that over the years. I don't need to be a part of a church. I don't need to be a part of a body. I don't need to be taught. I know everything that I need to know as a Christian. Here he says, no, you need to be mutually dependent, to have the same great interests at heart. We're called individually, but we're called to be a part of a body, and we cannot do it alone. We can't do it backed off and say, well, I've got everything to need. I need to do it by myself. God says, you've been called to be a part of something, and you have to contribute your part to that body. So we're expected to be mutually dependent one to another. We're to share the same interests, and that can be in the work, in what we have to do. It can be in the church itself. Sharing the same interest and sharing the same common goal for the future. Sharing the plan of God together, because the world doesn't do that. And we can't share in the plan of God with those in the world. They don't understand it. But we share something in common as a body. And of course, as the church continues to grow, and now in the process where we're looking to move our headquarters location, and because we have completely outgrown that, and having meetings there, when we have our camp director meetings or other meetings at particular times of the year, the conference room is completely filled around the table, around the outsides of the room, and it's pretty crowded, even just in having meetings, let alone with the Foundation Institute and other things that take place there. So now we have the need to look for a new property and to build a new location, and the church will actually benefit from that, from leasing or compared to leasing another building. But this is something that is taking place, and it's something that each of us individually can be involved in and as a part in prayers, in support, in asking God to provide what is necessary. But it is having that same mind and same interest at heart. Barnes says, as everyone is members one of another, that we are so united as to be mutually dependent, each one is of service to the other, and exist and the function is one of that is necessary to the usefulness of the other. Thus, the members of a body may said to be as members one of another, as the feet could not, for example, perform their function if it were not for the eye. It'd be difficult for your feet to do their function if you couldn't see. We've probably done that at night. Many of us probably gone walking somewhere at night in a room and can't see, and you trip over things or you stumble because your eyes help your feet know exactly what to do, where to walk. The ear, the hands, or the teeth, he said, would be useless if it were not for the other members, which go along to make up the entire person. And that's why he says, when one member of the body hurts, the whole body hurts. So if the eyes aren't doing their job and you break your toe on something, the entire body hurts and has sympathy for that little part of the body. But each one is necessary to complete the entire complete man. The work is not done by one individual, and I remember hearing that over and over and over. The work is not done by one man. We know that. It's not done by one group of men. It is done by the entire body and by everyone doing their part to which God has called them and placed them within that body. And we know that it is important to fulfill that role where God has placed us. Church doesn't operate even locally by one man. Fortunate, I don't have to do everything. I don't have to set up sound. I don't have to come in and do all these different things. Everybody has different jobs and duties and different things that they contribute to make services go well, to make activities like this go well, or even contributing in special music or music at all, or contributing in whatever way they can to the congregation to edify one another. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. He's the head of the body, and it is the joining of members to fulfill what needs to be done. He said, I've called you, I've placed you in the body, I've given you gifts, and I've given you abilities that you need to use, not just to edify yourself or to become something yourself. We do, because we're being transformed by it, but it is for the edifying of others. But we have to be there to be a part of it. Romans chapter 6 and verse, or 12 and verse 6. Romans 12 and verse 6. He said, having then gifts, having certain things that are given to us, differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. What good is a gift that is given to us if we're not using it? And he's talking about gifts that are given to us for the edifying of the rest of the body, or for the fulfilling of our part as a part of that body. He said, if you're not doing anything with it, what is it for? He said, use it. Let us use it. If prophecy, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. Or ministry, let us use it to ministering. Or he who teaches in teaching. He who exhorts in exhorting or exhortation. He who gives in liberality. And he who leads, let him do it with diligence. And he who shows mercy, with cheerfulness. Here are gifts that are listed. He said, each one of us have gifts that are given according to what God has chosen to give us. We need to use them. I don't think any of us focus enough on the gifts that God has given to us individually. And as was mentioned earlier, I think if we really considered what has been offered to us, or what God has chosen to give us individually, we would humble ourselves or be humbled by what we're not doing with all those particular things. But God says we need to use these to serve one another. So he said, let us use them. Let us put it to use. The word prophesy or prophecy does not mean one who's talented in speculating. Well, maybe prophecy is my gift and I'm going to go speculate and start talking about all these ideas of things that might be or could be as if they are. The word also means inspired speaking. He said, let one who is inspired in speaking use that to inspire. Now, it can also mean foretelling, but when we say one who prophesies, let him use that in prophecy, to be inspired in speaking. We have many in the church who are inspired speakers. We don't have many foretellers or people who foretell the future, and I think that's a good thing. God says he will reveal those things to us when it is necessary. But we do have inspired speakers, those who have a gift for speaking and inspiring individuals and causing them to recognize things or change within. Inspired speakers. And it's obvious sometimes when God works through certain individuals to be able to reach other people or to edify. It says to ministry, let us use it in our ministry. So does this apply only to ministers or preachers? He said, if you've been given the gift of ministry, use it in ministering. Do we ignore this because, well, I'm not a minister, so that one doesn't apply to me. That's not my gift. The word minister or ministry here means attendant or someone who is a servant. He said someone who serves. If it is someone who serves, let him use it for serving. Let him use it for ministering or serving other individuals. Somebody who attends to other individuals or somebody who gives relief to other individuals. We'll keep our place here in Romans, but let's look at Luke chapter 10 and verse 40. Luke chapter 10. And at verse 40, it's a story we're familiar with. It says, Martha was cumbered about with much serving and came to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Do you see what's happening? My sister's leave. I'm sitting here and I'm working and working and working and my sister's just sitting there. And bid her therefore that she can help me. So he says, Martha here was complaining that she was ministering alone. It is that same word. It says Martha was doing much serving or much ministry. It's not that she had a ministry of service. And of course, now we have individuals who say, well, everybody's got their own ministry. And so I've got a ministry of service or I've got a ministry of preaching. I had an individual tell me my ministry is to provide booklets to all kinds of organizations. And so I get booklets from everywhere and I just give them out to other organizations. A ministry. No, it means to serve. It is an attendant or one who serves or gives relief to other individuals. When we look at Martha here, what was it that she was doing? She wasn't preaching like a minister. She said, no, I'm doing all the work while my sister just sits there and listens. She was serving those individuals around her by providing drink and taking care of needs of the people that were there. But of course, we know that her focus was more on that than what it should have been. If that is our gift, if our gift is of serving, he says, use it. Put it to use. Next is teaching. Teaching can be described today in the church as sermonettes, sermons, split sermons, teen Bible studies, but it can also include any who teach. Writing articles, writing blogs, teaching by example, and this is one area of teaching that any one of us can do, and some are gifted in the ability to teach, not from a lectern or with a microphone, but teaching on a one-on-one basis or teaching by example. Let's go to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2 and verse 1. He said, as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. That the older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love and in patience, and the older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers and not given to much wine, teachers of good things. Here's another description of behaviors. Behaviors that are expected within the church. But he says, this is what you should act like. And, verse 4, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. To admonish young women, that's teaching and giving an education or an example or information to individuals. Admonish the young women to be what they should. To be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. Likewise, exhort the young men, teach the young men to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, and incorruptibility. Sound speech that cannot be condemned of one who is an opponent, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. He said, if you're living like you should, and your behavior and your conduct is what it should be, there should nothing evil be able to be said about you. He said, teach this to the younger women, teach it to the younger men. And that can be done by example. It doesn't have to be done formally or from the lectern, but there are different ways of teaching. And some have a gift for teaching. Growing up in the church, I learned from many in the congregation who were not ordained, who never were ordained, even until some of them till the time they died. But individuals who had a heart of service and working with them and watching them serve and talking to them, there are certain things that you can learn by being with individuals who are setting and teaching an example like that. Or women who had a gift of hospitality. That is a gift that is given, hospitality. And to see individuals and how they work with or how they respond to others and how they bring others in is a gift and is something that can be taught. But members who had been through the thick and thin of the early church years and telling their stories or telling of trials or difficulties they went through and what they learned from that and how they benefited, that is teaching and passing on information to the next generation. But they shared it. What do you have to offer in the area of teaching? Teaching doesn't, again, have to be something that we have a title, but teaching by example. And what is it that we can share and edify one another within the congregation? And are we using it as we're told to? It says, he who exhorts, for exhorting or in exhortation. What does it mean to exhort? What's interesting, we just mentioned hospitality. The word exhort means to invite, to call near, or to be a comfort to. He said, to those who exhort, or those who have the gift of exhortation, use it. To invite, to call near, or to be a comfort to. In modern language, it might be someone who invites you to dinner, or invites you to their home. Maybe someone who invites you to go out with them, or to be with them at a restaurant or another place. Maybe somebody that is simply there or there to show comfort for you. And if you're going through a difficulty or a trial, they're there for you. They invite you to share with them they invite you to share back, to be there for them or to be a comfort, as the word exhort means to be a comfort to. Maybe somebody who simply draws you near as a friend, or somebody who says, if you ever need anything, I want you to know I'm there for you. They open up of themselves and they give of themselves, so they exhort one another. They call near, they invite, and an invitation doesn't have to be a formal invitation where, okay, let's set a date and do this or that. It's, I want you to know I want to be a part of your life. That's an invitation. And here is to those who exhort, use it in exhorting. To draw near to other individuals and let them know that you are going to be there for them. That is a gift and something that should be used. To he who gives. The word gives means to share. To he who shares or gives. And that can be of time. That is something that is vital to give time to individuals, to let individuals know that I'm willing to put forth time into you because there's an interest there and there's a love of that body that we want to give of our time. We're giving of our abilities or talents, or even simply giving of ourselves. To he who gives or to he who shares, use it. Share your talents and abilities, but also share yourself. Don't just come and expect something and go back and then come the next week expecting something again. He says, I want you to share. I want you to contribute. Clark commentary says, he who distributes to the alms of the church with simplicity, being influenced by no partiality, says not just because you found somebody you like to give something to, and so you just, I'm particular who I'm going to share with or who I'm going to give to. Said not with partiality, but dividing to each according to the necessity of his case. That's where we go back to the early church in Acts. It said each one was given what they had need of. The members provided one for another. They shared. Or as it says here, they gave. And they used it. So it says, he who gives, let him do it with simplicity. And that's why it says, not with partiality, because it says with simplicity, and that word means sincerity or without self-seeking. He says, don't give because you're wanting something back, or don't give with the motive of, I want to be recognized for giving. It's not for the self. And he says, do it with simplicity, do it with sincerity. Other translations say, do it generously, not because you're expecting something in return. So it goes back to what we started with at the beginning. Do it in an attitude of being humble. Do it with sincerity and not with pride or not with vanity. Not with expecting something to come back to ourselves. How many times have we seen people give of their time or their money or service because they wanted something in return or they wanted recognized? Let's go to Matthew 23 and verse 1. Matthew chapter 23, and in verse 1, then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works. In other words, don't pattern yourselves or don't conform to what they're doing. For they say, and they do not. They bind heavy burdens hard to bear, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. He said, all their works they do to be seen by men. And of course, we've seen that over the years as well. Individuals who, it's like, wow, that individual serves so much. But then you talk to the individual and they say, I just like the recognition, or I do it because I feel important. He said, they do their works to be seen by men. They make phylacteries and broad and enlarge borders on their garments. They love the best places at the feast, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplace, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. Oh, you're a great teacher. You're something special. And so that's why they do what they do. Giving does not have to be something that is seen by others, and in many cases, we have many people who give of their time or do things that are unseen that are huge blessings and that are contributing to the rest of the group. Individuals who, when prayer requests go out saying, I'm praying for this person, I have been praying for them, do you have an update on them? Because I am concerned and I want to contribute what I can in prayer to help these individuals. Sadly, yet some won't serve unless they're seen. And I've heard people over the years say, well, what's in it for me? You know, we need some help over here. Well, what do I get out of it? You get to serve. If you have the right attitude, that should be something that you want to do. Matthew chapter 6. Matthew 6 and verse 1. He says, take heed that you do, or do not do, rather, your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. He said, don't be charitable or don't give just to be seen. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogue and in the streets, that they may have the glory of men. He say, I say unto you, they have their reward. They got looked at. They told everyone, you know, hey, guess what? I'm serving. Look what I'm doing. And they got everybody to look. I had a few people looking. But people will do that kind of thing to draw attention to them. He said they have their reward. But that's not what we are to serve for, what we are to seek recognition for. He said, therefore, when you do this, do it without sounding a trumpet. It's the attitude. I don't want to brag or anything, but I've given more money to the church than anyone I ever know. Or I serve more than anyone else here, and nobody recognizes what I do. Sadly, these are true statements and things that I've heard over the years. And sometimes people don't say those things openly. Some of them do. But sadly, that's the thought or mentality of some in the process of serving. I haven't been recognized for what I do. Is that what you're doing it for, to be recognized? Verse 3. He says, when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what the right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be done in secret. And your Father who is in secret will himself reward you openly. So he says, do it with simplicity. And in fact, that word simplicity means do it with a single frame of mind, something that is one reason. You don't do it because, well, I want to do it because it's right, but I also want to be recognized. He said, no, do it for a single purpose or single reason, with simplicity, for one reason or one thing, and that is that which is good. Back to Romans chapter 12. Back to Romans. And in verse 12, chapter 12, he continues, he who leads, or he who rules, do it with diligence. Again, we could say, well, leading, that's an ordained position, or that's an assigned position. Since I'm not assigned anything, I'm not a leader. He who leads, do it with diligence. The word actually means not only to be in a position over others, but in a leadership position. He said, let him do it with diligence, with eagerness or earnestness. And again, unless we think that only applies to somebody who is placed in a position or a title, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, he who rules or he who leads, whether in the church or whether in his own household. He references 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, in which both words are applied as ruling or leading. And we're to do that with diligence. In 1 Timothy 3, it says, one who rules his own house well. We're not titled as ruler of our house, but he says one who rules, and that, again, that means one who is leader of his house or rules his house, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? So how do we rule? How do we rule our households? How do we rule as Christians who have been given the gift of rulership or leadership even within our home? He who shows mercy with cheerfulness. The word here actually means to be compassionate or to have or to show mercy. Who can fill that role in the congregation of showing mercy or compassion? We don't have to have a title to do that. We don't have to be recognized for one who shows compassion. That is something that is a gift and something that we can do. And he says, do it with cheerfulness. And according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the word cheerfulness means not only without grudging either trouble or pecuniary relief, but feeling it to be more blessed to give than to receive, and to help rather than be helped. He said, just have an attitude of helping others, giving to others, pouring out of ourselves to others. right, verse 9. Romans chapter 12 and verse 9. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil and cling to what is good. More and more in this society, people are becoming callous to what is good. They're callous and they don't see it, they don't recognize it, and they're even callous to what is evil. Do we see our brother getting caught up in something and something that could be detrimental to them? Do we help another individual by saying something? Do we intervene on behalf of our brother to exhort our brother? That doesn't have to be something offensive or corrective, but it's talking about doing things in love. Do we see somebody that we can, if we have the opportunity and it presents itself to us, do we take that advantage and say, I want to help you if I can? Verse 10 says, be kindly affectionate one to another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another. According to Strong's, this word affectionate means to cherish one's own kindred, especially of parents or children, fraternal towards fellow Christians. Be kindly affectionate. He said, develop a love and a bond between individuals that have been called out to be a part of that same body, to where we become family, to love as family. Not only to enjoy one another, but he says to prefer one another, to prefer to be with one another. And again, we see examples of that, and those who have set wonderful examples of, I will never miss services. And we see people in Africa who walk 3 miles handicapped to be at services with other individuals, and they do that because they want to be there. They prefer to be with the people of God. They prefer one another. Clark commentary says, the word, which is translated kindly affection, signifies a tender and indescribable affection which a mother bears towards her child, or almost all creatures manifest towards their young. The word joined to it signifies a delight in it, and feeling the tenderest affections towards one another, and a delight to be able to feel that. To love a brother Christian with the affection of a natural brother. When he says you're called to be a part of one body, one mind, one spirit, one faith, we're called to be a part of the body of Christ, which is the house of the living God. So we're called to be part of a household. We're called to be part of a family. And we're to have love one for another and the desire and preference to be with one another as that body. Now, I love my natural family. I have a very diverse family. Our personalities and characteristics are quite different within my own personal family. But I have many in the church who are far closer to me than my family members ever have been. We're blood and we love each other as family, but there is a bond that God provides for us when he calls us and gives us his spirit. We know that that same spirit is in other individuals and that they are also called at this time to be a part of that body. There's a bond that develops. And he says, I want you to have that bond. I want it to be a natural affection and I want you to prefer that. I want you to have that type of desire. So there's a relationship that we develop in the church that goes on beyond just a loving physical relationship. It is a family relationship. We share in the future. We share now. We share that same spirit and that same spiritual body. Verse 11, it says, not lagging in diligence, or some translations will say, not slothful in business or purpose, but fervent in the spirit. Are we fervent in the Spirit? Or do we feel like asking ourselves, am I fervent in the Spirit? According to the Greek and Strong's, the word is Z-E-O, and it means to be hot. Are you hot? Are you on fire for God's way of life? Or is it just something that we do? Something that we've conformed to? Barnes states of this word fervent, the word is usually applied to water or metal as it's heated and bubbles and boils. When we see something bubbling and boiling, we know that's hot. That's something that is fervent. And he said, in spirit, meaning in your mind or in your heart. The expression is used to denote the mind that is filled with an intense ardor for whatever it is engaged in. Is it supposed that Christians would find appropriate objects for their labor and then engage in them with intense ardor and zeal? So we have a list of actions, a list of behaviors that are expected of us. And he said, part of these are gifts that are given to you. Use them. And he said, I want you to do it with a fervent zeal. I want you to do it because you're on fire to live that way of life and to be those things so that you can exhort and help an individual as another part of the body. So do we show that zeal and passion? And if not, we need to ask ourselves why, because that is a behavior that is expected and that God tells us is a behavior of a Christian. Do we share with the brethren that zeal and that way of life, or are we too busy to take the time to email or call or send a card to someone who is sick or to keep in touch with them, even if it's on the Sabbath day, just to ask them how they're doing or to be a part of their lives, to give of ourselves and to give of our time. It's not a time to be lukewarm or cold, and we know that that is a characteristic of the end time. It's something I plan to focus on in a couple of weeks. But we are to change and make sure that we're fervent. Verse 12, it says, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfast in prayer. And remember, these are principles of Christian living, but he's also saying some of these things are gifts that are given to us. Being steadfast in prayer. What is our prayer life like? Is our prayer life steadfast? It says being steadfast in prayer. Are we committed to it? He says in verse 13, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. He said, if we're given to hospitality, use it. Blessed are those who persecute you. Bless, do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. We've had several prayer requests lately, and some of them pretty heavy prayer requests of individuals who are suffering through particular trials and difficulties, and some of them severe in cases. Do we fervently pray for those individuals? Do we write them or email them or send them a card? Do we show that care? And do we use that gift? Verse 16, he says, be of the same mind one towards another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Started off with don't be wise, humble yourself, live these behaviors. And in verse 16, he says, don't be high-minded. He goes back to again, don't use these things to focus on the self. But he says, associate with the humble. International Standard Version says, live in harmony with each other. Do not be arrogant, but associate with humble people. Do not think that you are wiser than you really are, or think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. Verse 17, repay no one evil for evil, or trying to get back at individuals, or repay somebody, or hold a grudge against others. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. If you're doing your part and you're living the Christian life the way you should, it will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. This chapter is full of Christian living guidelines. It's something that is laid out for us as a behavior. Chapter 13 goes on to talk about how a Christian should relate in society with governing authority, taxes, example. But there's a behavior that is expected in the house of God, which is the church of the living God. He said, there's a behavior that I want you to have. There is gifts that I've given to you to edify other individuals within that body so that everyone's doing their part and so that body can function the way it should. Romans chapter 12 tells us we need to work individually on ourselves. We need to develop what's been given to us. But it's not just for ourselves, it's as a body. And it is for the transformation. As we begin to take on the traits and characteristics of the talents that are given to us, we begin to be transformed ourselves as individuals, but also as a whole. As we prepare for the spring holy days, we're going to hear much more about that transformation process that we have to go through, something that we need to take heed and listen and learn. But God has laid out certain things for us, and He says, don't be conformed to this world. Go through the changes of being transformed, to be changed by the things that you began to live as a way of conduct and as a way of behavior.